From the heart of our nation's capital in Washington, D.C., bringing compelling interviews, insightful analysis, taking you beyond the headlines and soundbites into conversations with our nation's leaders and newsmakers, all from a biblical worldview, Washington Watch with Tony Perkins starts now.
Your campaign slogan is a new way forward, and it's time to turn the page. You've been vice president for 3.5 years, so what are you turning the page from?
Well, first of all, turning the page from the last decade in which we have been burdened with the kind of rhetoric coming from Donald Trump that has been designed and implemented to divide our country.
That was Vice President Kamala Harris in an interview with Brett Baer on Fox News. We'll turn the page and talk about it. Welcome to Washington Watch. Thanks for tuning in. Well, breaking news from Israel, Yahya Sinwar, the Hamas leader in the Gaza Strip and the mastermind behind October 7th, has been killed by IDF forces in Gaza. We'll have more on this from South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham in just a moment. We'll also discuss the latest developments in the Biden-Harris administration's warning to withhold munitions from Israel if they don't allow more aid into Gaza. And the growing controversy around experimental transgender medical procedures for minors has become both a cultural and a political flashpoint. So far, over 24 states have passed laws protecting minors from life-altering surgeries and treatments. However, transgender activists have taken some of these laws to court. And one of the key challenges is now headed to the U.S. Supreme Court. FRC has filed a brief in this case, and I'll be talking with Christopher Mills. He's a principal at Spiro Law and a former clerk to Justice Clarence Thomas, who wrote our brief for us. We'll talk about the arguments in that brief. In August, the Department of Labor revised its job numbers. You remember that? Stating that there were actually 818,000 fewer jobs created than they claimed. Now, this was long after the confetti was swept up and the headlines heralding the success of the Biden-Harris economic policy were long gone. Well, the same thing has happened again, this time on crime. Originally celebrating a 2.1% drop in crime, the Biden-Harris administration so far has been silent. When the revised numbers revealed a historic 4.5% rise in violent crime. Dr. John R. Lott, Jr., founder and president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, will join us with more on the numbers and what they reveal. And as violent crime continues to rise in cities nationwide, people are seeking solutions. In my hometown of Baton Rouge, one man is stepping up to make a difference. Football coach Sid Edwards will join me in studio to share how he's taking action by stepping onto a different field. That's coming up later on this edition of Washington Watch. All right, election season is upon us. Early voting has started in key states across the country. I hope you're prepared. We want to help you cast an informed ballot. So, if you'd like more resources, you can text the word toolkit, that's one word, toolkit, to 67742, and at your fingertips, you'll have everything you need to cast an informed ballot. Again, that's toolkit, one word, to 67742. Earlier today, the Israeli military announced that Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar, the architect of the October 7th terrorist attack, was killed in a firefight in southern Gaza. Now, this came after U.S. warplanes and B-2 stealth bombers yesterday attacked underground weapons facilities in Yemen, striking in areas controlled by the Iranian-backed Houthi terrorist group. Joining me now by phone to discuss this, Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina. He serves on 4 Senate committees, including the Senate Appropriations Committee and the Senate Judiciary Committee, where he's the ranking member. Senator Graham, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you, Tony, very much.
So let me ask you this. Is this a game changer with the elimination of Sinwar, who was the mastermind behind October 7th and the leader of Hamas in Gaza?
Absolutely, it's a game changer. And hats off to our friends in Israel, the political leadership, Bibi in particular. But the IDF, the intelligence agency, is a major accomplishment. It's equivalent to killing bin Laden. It cuts the head of the snake off. Somebody may try to replace him, but Hamas is tremendously diminished. And why does it change the game? When you destroy Hamas militarily and politically, you have an opportunity to do in Gaza what we did in Germany and Japan, rebuild the place from extremist the people that can live in peace with their neighbor. So it does create a possibility for Arabs like Saudi Arabia in the United Arab Emirates to come in and fill the vacuum created by the demise of Hamas, which would be great news for Israel because the UAE and Saudi Arabia are willing to live in peace with Israel.
Now, with Sinwar, I understand he had kind of veto power over the negotiations taking place regarding the hostages and a ceasefire. Does this change, kind of the rearrange the geopolitical landscape there in the Middle East?
It, potentially, I think. Now, in Bibi's speech just a moment ago, he was calling on people who have the hostages in custody that you'll get safe passage, you deliver the hostages. The question is, was Sinwar's brother killed? Will he take over? But the biggest loser in all of this is Iran. I've never believed the hostages would be released until there's a real diminishment of the influence of Iran. So with Hezbollah suffering losses of leadership and fighters in Lebanon, and now the killing of Sinwar, I think Iran's ability to use their proxies, Hamas and Hezbollah, has been reduced. So you have an opening not only for the hostage deal, but to implement what I've been working on for a year and a half. As you remember, and you're one of the most well-informed people I know about the Mideast, the Abraham Accords, negotiated by President Trump, where six Arab nations recognized Israel, can be built upon. The ultimate Arab country to recognize Israel would be Saudi Arabia. I think the death of Sinwar makes that more likely than ever, and that's a nightmare to Iran for the Arabs to make peace with Israelis. My hope is to kick Hezbollah out of Lebanon and to kick Iran out of Syria down the road, but I think October 7th was designed to prevent further reconciliation between the Arabs and Israel, building on the Abraham Accords. And so this is a big blow to Iran as well as to Hamas.
If that happens, if Saudi Arabia comes into a formalized relationship with Israel, then you have a united Arab front which stands against Iran and what they're trying to do in the Middle East, do you not?
Oh, you do, and that's the ultimate change in our lifetimes. You know, the hope has always been for the Arabs to march toward the light away from the darkness. The Abraham Accords were historic. President Trump, with Jared Kushner and others, persuaded six Arab nations to not allow the Palestinians to have a veto. And they went ahead and made peace with Israel. You know, the holy sites of Mecca, Medina, and Saudi Arabia is the most influential country in the Muslim world.
Right.
If you could get MBS, who's inclined to do it, to recognize Israel and have diplomatic ties, then you've effectively ended the Arab-Israeli conflict, which is a nightmare for Iran. And again, I'll go back to October 7th. The intel is clear. One of the main reasons this attack occurred was to stop the march toward normalization between Saudi and Israel, a nightmare for Iran.
Let's talk about the Biden-Harris administration and their policy toward both Israel and Iran. Earlier this week, the Biden-Harris administration threatened an arms embargo to our ally Israel if enough, you know, to their satisfaction, humanitarian aid was not flowing into Gaza. Your thoughts on that threat?
Well, number one, I think it's ill-timed, ill-conceived, and at every turn, the Biden administration has had one foot out and one foot in when helping Israel. This idea that Israel should not destroy Hamas militarily was stupid. They've been trying to hold Israel back from going into Rafah. They've been restricting weapons like 2,000-pound bombs. And Israel was smart enough and clear enough in their thinking to go in into Rafah and destroy Hamas militarily, which they've virtually done. So the idea of withholding weapons at a time of critical momentum is absurd. I hope they revisit that policy, but I promise you there'll be a big pushback in the Congress because we appropriated money for these weapons. So you could have a conflict between the Congress and the Biden administration. And I think today is a game changer. And the best way to help the Palestinian people is to do what we did in Germany and Japan. Destroy the radical elements running those nations, the Nazis and the you know, emperor worshippers in Japan, and over time de-radicalize the population. That's the only way to really help the Palestinians. And I would just add this. They're the most radicalized people on the planet, the Palestinians. They're taught from birth to death to kill the Jews, and that needs to stop.
Senator, I want to stay on the foreign policy front, but move to another issue in the Pacific. There's not, you know, my 20 years in Washington, I've realized there's not that many members of Congress that are really, really well informed on foreign policy issues. You're one of them, so I want to try to squeeze out as much as I can when I talk with you. I want to play this clip of Kamala Harris from yesterday regarding Taiwan. Clip number nine.
What is your position were there to be an invasion of Taiwan by the Chinese military under, if you were president at the
time?
Well,
let me restate the point I've made many times. I believe in the one China policy, and I believe that there, and that Taiwan has a right to defend itself.
Senator, you can do both.
Yeah. So here's the problem. When they pulled out of Afghanistan, it was the dumbest decision in modern American political history. It not only set in motion the comeback of ISIS in Afghanistan, they just arrested a guy last week, an Afghan refugee in America, being recruited by ISIS-K, now housed in Afghanistan, to attack us on Election Day. We've lost deterrence. So I think Russia invaded Ukraine because of Biden looking weak. And here's what Trump would do, I believe, if he wins, and I hope he does. You'll let the Chinese know we want to have a good relationship, but you do not want to invade Taiwan. You do so at your own peril. And what Biden did by taking nuclear-tipped cruise missiles out of our submarines in the South China Sea is to send a signal of weakness. So I don't really believe anybody in China is afraid of Harris, but I promise you they're afraid of Trump. And if you want to prevent spreading of war to Asia, elect Trump.
Speaking of the vice president, wide-ranging conversation, sometimes combative, that she had with Bret Baier, Fox News, last night. Do you think she won anyone over in that interview?
Yeah, that's a good question. Here's what I think. I've always thought the reason she won when Bret did a great job. He's a fair man. He asked good, hard questions. She gave, like, gibberish answers. You know, how many illegal immigrants have been released into the country on your watch is not an unfair question. She couldn't answer the question because either she didn't know or she's embarrassed about the number. So I don't think she won anybody over. That wasn't the goal. The goal was to go on Fox and be the victim. And they're going to play that interview in the left and throughout the Democratic world to say she went into the lion's den and she stood up. I think that was the goal all along. And the truth of the matter is, if you're having to do that, you're in trouble. If those people need to be persuaded this late, you're in trouble. From an independent voter's point of view, if you watch that interview and you believe she's capable of leading this country, you're making a mistake. I think it just reinforced how ill-prepared she is to be president of the United States. I think it was a disaster for her.
Well, I think you're right in terms of especially sidestepping the immigration. I think she didn't want to answer the question because it shows the failure of the Biden-Harris administration. Senator, we're out of time. Always great to talk with you. Thanks so much for taking time to join us on this Thursday.
Thank you, Tony, and just thank you for what you've done for Israel and to all the listeners. Keep praying. God bless.
All right, we will. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, and I do want to encourage you to continue to pray. It's far from over, but progress is being made, and continue to pray for Israel and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. All right, after the break, we're going to talk about a Supreme Court case coming up. Don't go away.
We humbly, Father, bow before you in these moments that we have together, that this wouldn't just be any other conference, but that literally, Lord, you would reset our hearts to be in alignment with your word, that you would reset the city of Washington, D.C. to be in realignment with your word.
There's no politician, including Trump, that can affect the soul of this nation. You're the only one. The answer's not in the State House, and it's not going to be in the White House. It's got to be in your own house. It's got to be in the Church of God. It's got to be in His house.
Our principles never bend to politicians.
Yes.
Our principles never bend to politicians. By God's grace, it will be the other way around. Politicians will bend to our biblically based child protective principles. principles.
No matter what comes in November, no matter if it doesn't go the way you want or I want or the things we prayed for, our focus and priorities do not change as Christians. We fight against evil. We stand for truth. We tell people the good news of Jesus Christ. We tell them the truth.
So let's not be discouraged. Don't lose heart. Don't lose the faith. Stand now strong, because the Lord has given us the great privilege of living in a time when our choices matter, when our lives matter, when our courage matters. So let's stand together and save this great country. God bless the United States of America.
There are 40 million self-described evangelical Christians who do not vote in a presidential election. If half of those people who sit in church on their blessed assurance would pray, stand, and vote, we would change every election in this country from the school board all the way to the White House.
All it takes, friends, is one generation for us to lose what is valuable, important, and sacred. Every generation has the opportunity to preserve what is right, what is godly, what is good about the United States of America, or to shirk our responsibilities and to watch what happens in just one generation in our country.
This may not be an easy task, but we are living in a moment of challenge, but also of great opportunity. And we know, always, that we are not alone, that His Spirit empowers us and protects us, and that He can do the unimaginable. Dobbs, after all, was never supposed to happen.
Father, we thank You. You have entrusted us with this moment in history, and I pray that we would be found faithful, and that as a result of our faithfulness to You, that thousands, millions would come into the kingdom as they would experience the forgiveness of sin and the new life that is found only in Jesus Christ. Amen.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Good to have you with us on this Thursday. Let me again give you a link to where you can get information so that you can cast an informed ballot. And you can share this with your friends. Toolkit. Toolkit. One word. Toolkit to 67742. It'll take you to the Stand Firm app. It's got a link. Just go ahead and follow it through, and you'll have a lot of resources at your hand, including prayer points for this election. Because we need to be praying. We need to pray. We need to vote. We need to stand. Again, that's toolkit, one word, toolkit to 67742. The Biden-Harris administration has been anything but passive in their push for transgender procedures on minors. I mean, this is really, as I've described before, I describe it as demonic. It is. It is confusing these kids. It is leading them down a path of destruction. Well, this term of the Supreme Court, they're going to consider the Biden-Harris administration's challenge to a Tennessee law that bans these procedures and this mutilation of children. Now, you'll recall we've talked about this many times. We were part of putting together the very first one in Arkansas. Now, over 24 states have these laws. Many of them have been challenged. This one is going all the way to the Supreme Court. Now, accordingly, because we've been invested in this, the Family Research Council filed a brief this week in support of the Tennessee legislation, which highlighted the glaring lack of evidence behind the standards the Biden-Harris administration has cited to support these permanent experimental procedures from the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, or WPATH. Joining me now to discuss this brief is Christopher Mills. He's a principal at Spiro Law and a former clerk for Justice Thomas. He worked with FRC to write and file this brief. Christopher, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me.
So first, kind of give us a timeline. What is a brief? Why are these filed with the court in advance of oral arguments? How does that work? Just explain that for our viewers and listeners.
Sure. So before the court, Supreme Court hears a case, each side gets to file briefs. So the Biden administration filed its brief a few months ago, and then all the outside groups, friends of the court, filed amicus briefs supporting the Biden administration a couple months ago as well. And then just in the last couple weeks, the state of Tennessee defending their law, and all the friends of the court on Tennessee's side, including the Family Research Council, and many other groups filed amicus briefs, sort of elaborating and expanding on Tennessee's defense of the law.
Now, Christopher, you worked for, you clerked for Justice Thomas. How does that work? I mean, does this actually play a role in the process? Do the justices and their clerks look at these briefs?
Definitely. These briefs are important because the main parties, the Biden administration, the state of Tennessee, only have a limited number of pages and a limited number of words. And especially in cases like this, there's a lot of complicated moving parts. So you've not only got complicated legal arguments about the Constitution, what equal protection means, how that applies in the context of gender issues, and then also all these factual, medical, scientific questions about treatments for gender dysphoria itself. And so there's a lot of room to cover that can't be done just by the parties.
All right. So, Christopher, walk us through the amicus brief that you worked on for the Family Research Council and filed.
Sure. So the cornerstone of the Biden administration's argument in this case is that every major American medical association agrees that minors should be subjected to gender transition, chemical interventions, puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, and then, you know, though they don't like to talk about this, surgeries to transition their gender. So the emphasis is on the consensus of American medical groups. And the brief we filed says, well, let's take a closer look at that consensus. Why does that consensus depart from what the rest of the world is doing? You know, the United Kingdom just did a massive review and stopped puberty blockers for minors because the evidence just wasn't there. Scotland just stopped puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones because the evidence wasn't there. But the American medical groups have done totally the opposite. They've said, you know, we don't really care what the evidence is. And so our brief tries to expose that. You know, early on in that early Arkansas case you talked about, the American medical groups, WPATH, the AAP, the AMA, came in and said there's a robust body of empirical evidence supporting these interventions in kids. And that's just not true. And we called them out on it, and they deleted it from their brief. And they didn't say that to the Supreme Court. Now they basically say, trust us, we're the experts. And we go through both historical examples of why it might not be a good idea to trust anything that, quote, medical experts have to say, whether you want to look at eugenics or smoking or opioids. And then we go through the specific studies in this area and expose how weak it is. And it's not surprising. I mean, these are very new interventions, and they're really dangerous. Puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones will, for many children, lead to permanent sterility, permanent changes in their body. And we're asking kids at ages 9, 10, and 11 to make these life-altering decisions, even while at the same time the AAP says that kids that age shouldn't be able to consent to a tattoo. And right. So I think the ideological capture of the American medical groups is really what our brief tries to focus on. When they speak on this issue, it is not based on evidence, it is based on ideology.
And it's been revealed that WPATH guidelines were crafted not to promote the health of their patients, but to ensure reliable insurance coverage and defend that windfall in cash flow from legal challenges, did it not?
That's exactly right. And repeatedly, those internal emails have showed that WPATH was not focused on the evidence. Their own scientific reviews from John Hopkins said, hey, we're really not finding much good evidence to go on here. But things like, are we going to be able to characterize this as medically necessary so that we can get insurance coverage? Can we give cover to physicians who are already doing these treatments so they don't get sued for malpractice? And, you know, how can we write these standards so that we can win cases like the one before the Supreme Court? So, in other words, they were thinking about practically everything except the scientific evidence. And who gets harmed from that is right. Kids.
Yeah, what happened
kids
to the Hippocratic?
Who are mentally vulnerable. Yeah.
What happened to the Hippocratic Oath? I guess it kind of went out the window. Christopher Mills, I want to thank you for joining us. Thank you for working on that brief and getting that before the court for us.
Of course. Good to be with you.
All right, Christopher Mills. And you can find out more. Go to TonyPerkins.com. This issue is not going away. It is a big issue. We're even seeing it in the presidential election. It's front and center because it's a big deal, very big deal. All right, after the break, the FBI quietly updated its 2022 crime data. And that, of course, was after the Biden-Harris administration was trumpeting a decrease in crime. Well, it turns out it actually went up at a historic level. Don't go away. We're back with more after this.
Everything we do begins as an idea. Before there can be acts of courage, there must be the belief that some things are worth sacrificing for. Before there can be marriage, there is the idea that man should not be alone. Before there was freedom, there was the idea that individuals are created equal. It's true that all ideas have consequences, but we're less aware that all consequences are the fruit of ideas. Before there was murder, there was hate. Before there was a Holocaust, there was the belief by some people that other people are undesirable. Our beliefs determine our behavior, and our beliefs about life's biggest questions determine our worldview. Where did I come from? Who decides what is right and wrong? What happens when I die? Our answers to these questions explain why people see the world so differently. Debates about abortion are really disagreements about where life gets its value. Debates over sexuality and gender and marriage are really disagreements about whether the rules are made by us or for us. What we think of as political debates are often much more than that. They're disagreements about the purpose of our lives and the source of truth. As Christians, our goal must be to think biblically about everything. Our goal is to help you see beyond red and blue, left and right, to see the battle of ideas at the root of it all. Our goal is to equip Christians with a biblical worldview and help them advance and defend the faith in their families, communities, and the public square. Cultural renewal doesn't begin with campaigns and elections. It begins with individuals turning from lies to truth. But that won't happen if people can't recognize a lie and don't believe truth exists. We want to help you see the spiritual war behind the political war, the truth claims behind the press release, and the forest from the trees.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Good to have you with us. Be sure and utilize our toolkit, our election toolkit. It'll give you everything you need at your fingertips to cast an informed ballot, and it's something you can share with family and friends. Just text the word toolkit to 67742. That's toolkit to 67742. That's one word. All right, throughout the year, the legacy media has run cover for Democrats' election prospects by claiming that crime is trending down after a historic surge continued following the summer of 2020 riots. Now, we saw that play out just last month in the presidential debate between former President Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris.
Despite their fraudulent statements that they made, crime in this country is through the roof. And we have a new form of crime. It's called migrant crime. And it's happening at levels that nobody thought possible.
President Trump, as you know, the FBI says overall violent crime is actually coming down in this country. But Vice
Excuse
President
me, the
Harris,
FBI defraud. They were defrauding statements. They didn't include the worst cities. They didn't include the cities with the worst crime. It was a fraud, just like their number of 818,000 jobs that they said they created turned out to be a fraud.
Well, guess what? This week, the FBI quietly updated its 2022 crime data to show an increase in violent crimes. Violent crime actually did not drop, as they claimed, by 2.1%. Actually, it rose by an additional 4.5%. Now that, according to the experts, is a historic rise in terms of an adjustment. Never before has there been that significant of adjustment in the numbers. Is it a problem with doing the math or telling the truth? Joining me now to discuss this, Dr. John Lott, president of the Crime Prevention Research Center. During the Trump administration, he served as the senior advisor for research and statistics in the Office of Justice Programs and then the Office of Legal Policy in the U.S. Department of Justice. John, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
So there's a consistent White House legacy media narrative that the Biden-Harris administration has lowered crime. They ran with some numbers, now adjusted those numbers, but really aren't telling anybody about what appears to be a quite a significant adjustment in the numbers.
Right. I mean, these numbers came out last month in September. Unfortunately, if you read the press release, there was no mention of the change for 2022. If you read the report itself, there was just a footnote that vaguely indicated that there had been an update to the 2022 numbers, but no explanation about the size of the change, or even if it was a change in direction, or why the change was made. But you know, the important thing is that there are two types of numbers for crime. There's crimes reported to police, and that's what the FBI measures. And then there's total crimes, and that's what the Bureau of Justice Statistics measures. And if my guess is most people care about anything, they care about total crimes, not just what gets reported to police. And during the Biden administration, another report came out last month from the Bureau of Justice Statistics showing that total violent crime, rape, robbery, and aggravated assault had increased by 55% during the Biden administration, after falling by 15% under Trump. And you know, that's historically the largest three-year change that we've had since the Bureau of Justice Statistics started collecting data on that. The media, though, has wanted to focus solely on the FBI data. They keep on calling it crime data when it should just be referred to as reported crimes. And the reason why I think that they've wanted to focus only on that and give, like, no coverage in the mainstream media to the Bureau of Justice Statistics report that came out last month is that it fits their narrative that it was falling. The irony is that for the last year, they've been using the 2022 data, which showed a 2.1% drop. And now it's clear that the FBI numbers showed an increase, but you're not seeing anybody going back and saying, oops, you know, all those news stories that we've been having there were wrong.
But John, even with the media carrying that false narrative, it didn't appear that the American people were buying it, because they've seen that increase in crime that you made reference to that's historic.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, you look at surveys. In March this year, Gallup did a survey on what issues were most important to people in the election. Crime and violence was number two. Obviously, that also fits in with the immigration issue that's there. But beyond that, you have surveys from Gallup to Rasmussen that show that large majorities of Americans believe that violent crime has been increasing. But look, if you live in many urban areas in the United States, whether it be Los Angeles or Chicago or D.C. or New York, you go to a CVS or a Walgreens and you see almost everything's behind plexiglass now. If you want to go and buy something, a sales clerk has to come over, unlock it, and then stand next to you while you read the different ingredients on the packages, trying to decide what it is you want to go and buy. People know that that wasn't the case a few years ago. You know, in many parts of this country, if you call up 911, they'll ask you if the criminal is there committing the crime. And if the criminal's already left, what they'll tell you is, well, you can come down to the police station and wait in line, and we'll then fill out a police report. You know, you make it more difficult, more time consuming for people to go and file police reports, and fewer people are going to do so. And it's one of many reasons why referencing the FBI reported crime data is not going to give you a very accurate measure of what's happening with total crime.
Yeah, makes perfect sense. John, we're out of time, but I appreciate you joining us in providing greater insight into these numbers. Always good to see you.
Well, thank you. People can find more at our website at crimeresearch.org, crimeresearch.org.
All right. We'll tell people to check that out. Be sure and check it out. They've been using these numbers, playing with it. Well, speaking of crime, we're going to talk about it next with a high school football coach whose team was impacted by crime, and he's doing something about it.
Jesus said in John 15, "These things I've spoken to you, that my joy may remain in you, and that your joy may be full." In 2024, in these divided and uncertain times, how can this be possible? By abiding in him through his word. At Family Research Council, we want to help you do that, which is the reason for the Stand on the Word Bible reading plan. In just 10 to 15 minutes each day, you will have read the entire Bible in just 2 years. But more importantly, you will be abiding in him daily. Find our Bible reading plan at frc.org/Bible. And join Tony Perkins each weekday for a 10-minute devotional inspired by the daily reading and designed to encourage you on this journey through the Bible. Listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. And remember, the grass withers and the flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever.
The world is hurting. Streets are filled with crime. Families are broken. Sin is celebrated and God is mocked. Everywhere we look, the wages of our sin are on full display. As Christians, we know that surrender to God's will is the solution to our biggest problems, but not everyone agrees. Even in church, we hear people say the most important thing is to be tolerant, that we shouldn't impose a morality on other people, and that loving our neighbor means celebrating what they do. But you can't do that. It's not that you don't love your neighbor, you do. But you care about God's opinion more than your neighbor's opinion, and this makes you different. In fact, sometimes it makes you feel alone, like you're the only one. But there is good news. You are not alone, not even close. Research has found that there are 59 million American adults who are a lot like you. There are millions of people around the country who are born again, deeply committed to practicing their faith, and believe the Bible is the reliable word of God. But that's not all. They're also engaged in our government. They're voters. They're more likely to be involved in their community, and they're making a difference in elections. The problem is that a lot of them feel alone, too. We want to change that. FRC wants to connect these 59 million Americans to speak the truth together, no matter the cost. If you want to learn more about this group and what it means to be a spiritually active, governance-engaged conservative, or if you want to find out if you are one of these sage cons yourself, go to frc.org/sagecon and take the quiz to find out. The world is hurting, and we have the solution. We can't do it alone, but we can do it if we work together. That's what we're working toward every day. Join us. Go to frc.org/sagecon, sagecon, to learn more. That's sagecon, sagecon, to learn more.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. Good to have you with us. And again, let me encourage you to be prepared to vote. All right, voting has already occurring. Early voting has begun in many jurisdictions across the country. And you need tools. And we want you to cast an informed ballot. And so we've got a toolkit available for you. And you can find it by texting the word toolkit to 67742. That's toolkit to 67742. There's a lot there for you. Maybe you're not registered. You can find out how to register. Maybe you need a voter guide. You can find that there. You can find information on the candidates. Again, toolkit to 67742. All right, crime, as we've been talking about, continues to rise in cities across America. We often look at the statistics, okay? We look at the statistics, the numbers. But, you know, behind every number is face. Behind every number is a name, sometimes unknown. But as you get down to the lower level, you know, the closer to home, you begin to feel this, you begin to see it, you begin to understand it. Increasingly, more and more Americans are becoming victims of crime, or family members are becoming victims of crime, or they're seeing it. I remember as a kid, a long time ago, but it stuck with me. A shooting right in front of our vehicles. We were driving down the road. A man stepped out and shot another man. And I'm like, this was surreal. Well, that's becoming almost a daily occurrence in some cities across this nation. In fact, a recent report on crime placed my home city of Baton Rouge, I live outside the city, but the city was placed on the top 10 list of the most dangerous cities in America. Now, this was not news to Coach Sid Edwards, the head football coach of an inner-city school in Baton Rouge. He's been a coach for 43 years. Crime has become very personal to him. The violence of the city has affected not just him personally, but those around him. And he's decided to step onto another field to address the impact of crime. And he joins me now in studio. Coach Sid Edwards, welcome to Washington Watch.
Glad to be here. I appreciate it.
So let me just begin with this question. Give us a little bit of your background. You're a football coach. You've told me you're kind of apolitical. You've just been coaching kids for 43 years. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, that's been my mission. I'm a long time football coach. I've coached softball, track, basketball, baseball, you name it. A coach is a coach. And that's what I've been doing. And I use sport to reach kids.
Something happened just a few years ago here in Baton Rouge, and we're in our Baton Rouge studio recording this interview, or bringing this interview to our folks. You had one of your star students. You had a lot of hope, a lot of prospects. Something happened. Tell us about it.
That actually was on January 1st of this year. And young man, he's 14 years old, turned 15 on Christmas, actually. Bright student, bright future. Him and four friends were walking down Evangeline Street in North Baton Rouge, 70805 zip code, and they were gunned down. And my kid that was on my team, he died. And we had to bury that young man. And, you know, from that January 1st point out of Struma High School, there's been four other children that have ties to the school or was at school that have been shot and or murdered. And it's mind-boggling, you know, that our youth have this to deal with daily.
A lot of this is gang-related. There's a lot of underlying issues here. There's the breakdown of the family. But you told me a part of the story as the coach. You're invested in these kids. This is inner-city minority school. You called the kids in over vacation time. This is during the Christmas break. You called them to come in to try to counsel with them and help them through the grief of losing a teammate. What happened there?
It was surreal to me. I was ready for some deep counseling, you know, to work with these boys. And not all of them, but the majority of them, it was callous. It was, best way I could put it, just another day in their lives. Like we may get a flat tire or have car trouble or something like that occurs every now and then. That's kind of how they took it that day. And that was an eye-opener for me, how desensitized those young people have become.
So it's become a part of the culture. It's just another day, as you said, in the neighborhood.
It's expected. It's sad. And they walk around. I don't think that they have enough sense to have some fear, you know, and know where danger is and keep their head on a swivel. But at the same time, I guess for someone who doesn't understand this concept or this lifestyle, it'd be no different that, you know, someone, hey, I'm going to play around the golf and we may get a thunder shower, you know, not expecting it, but it may happen.
So, Coach, what does this do for young people in terms of their vision of the future and their hope and what they focus on? If this is just a way of life where you may be walking down the street and randomly shot and killed by a drive-by shooting, I mean, how does that impact your view of the world?
Well, it absolutely not much hope. And I think, I mean, we have a lot of bright, bright kids on that side of town that could have bright futures. But when you live in, if you don't know, I'm almost to the point of, they're almost to the point of, hey, there may not be no tomorrow. Well, then how do you live? They're victims of trauma. It is a trauma-ridden community. But it's not just privy to 70805.
Right.
It's all over the parish.
Now, you've coached in other communities. You coached in the community that I lived, the Central community, when we actually helped get that school district established apart from the parish, which is an affluent area. Right. Where you're at now is not. Is there a lack of understanding from one community to the other of how life really is for many in the inner city?
100% a misunderstanding. Many of the residents in North Baton Rouge don't want to live that way. If you go through, many have their homes as nice as they can have their homes. Their lawns and the yards look really good. And there's a lot of people over there working hard to make ends meet. They don't want to live like they're living.
Yeah.
But people would travel to Plank Road Corridor or Winburn, but you have to peel back the curtain. Because when you get into the heart of that side of the city, the despair and hopelessness is rampant.
But it's good to point out, because I recall this, and it's been 30 years ago, but when I was a police officer in Baton Rouge on the streets in the bottoms, mm-hmm. much of those same areas, that there were people who wanted the best for their kids. Most of the time, grandmothers looking mm-hmm. for the best for their grandsons, and they wanted law and order. They wanted structure. that's not the stereotypical view of an inner city community is inaccurate. Not everybody there wants to be in the midst of chaos and crime. This prompted you to step out of your comfort zone. And I'm looking at this from a standpoint of, you know, not just Baton Rouge. I obviously have a vested interest in there. I live in that community. But this is indicative of communities across this nation. I mean, the crime is a national epidemic at the levels of violence we see. You decided to do more than just, you know, comment on the chaos. You tell us what you did.
Well, I qualified to run for the mayor president position of East Baton Rouge Parish, and I got asked a lot of times, why, Coach, why? One of the things I had to do was I had to find out, can I do it? So I started looking at the job description, and the answer was unequivocally, absolutely, it can be done. It's no different than building leadership and building a team. And at the same time, people got asked me, why wouldn't you step up, maybe start with the Metro Council? And I'm a head coach. And I think I've been an assistant coach 1 year during my whole career. And I think the most impact for our parish would be in the seat of mayor president. And once I learned that, okay, yes, this is not rocket science. There's a ton of common sense in this deal. Once I decided, yes, I can do that, that's when I got in. And I think I could make a difference.
And just for complete clarity, Washington Watch and Family Research Council does not endorse or support candidates. But I find this story so compelling and interesting that here's a football coach. And look, I played football in high school. You and I are the same age. I served with coaches in politics myself. Coaches are universally loved. Politicians are not. In fact, you know, oftentimes, you know, of course, you get to being a football coach at the level of like LSU, you know, they either love you or hate you. But most football coaches are universally loved, especially at the high school football level. You had to consider that stepping into the political arena, that this was football's a contact sport, but so is politics.
I'm learning extremely quick. I mean, I've saw like on TV and past campaigns, the mudslinging and all that type stuff. And now I'm victim to it. I'm learning. I'm trying to take the high road for sure. And I think when you see that, when politicians fight like that or mudsling, it's because they feel they have to become the mayor or president, or they have to become the president, or they have to become a senator. What sets me apart, I don't have to be the mayor or president. I want to be, and I know I could do a good job, and I know I could help save this parish, but I don't have to be. I think a lot of people in public office, it's the idea they have to be.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where I'm a little different.
Coach, let's talk about, again, I want to broaden this out. I don't think Baton Rouge is unique in the sense of the crime and the breakdown of the family and all of the pathologies that we're dealing with. But a lot of people see the problems, but they don't do anything about it. What would you say to others who are in cities across this nation that see the breakdown of society? What should they do? How should they respond? I mean, other than just, you know, we don't need any more commentators. We don't need any more critics. We actually need people on the field to make a difference. Well, what would you say?
Well, it's a multi-layered approach to help with this. You know, it starts certainly with the breakdown of the family. And I think the local churches, the pastors, you know, are going to play a huge role in that part. But there's so many layers to crime, and it's coming up with a plan and then making a plan work. I mean, as a football coach, I've had many plans. They haven't all worked, you know. But we go into it thinking they are, and then if it don't work, we fix it and we know what to do the next time, okay? And so you can't police yourself out of crime, you know, but that is an important piece.
Right.
Law enforcement officers were shorthanded in our parish, and they're not paid what I consider to be a fair wage. You have to start there and take care of them.
So crime is a symptom. It is not the cause. It's a symptom of a deeper cause that we're seeing all across our nation, in society as a whole. It's a breakdown of the family. It's a I think, and you've been an educator, you've been in the educational circles for four decades, I think it's also a marginalization of the role of faith in our public life. I think, you know, when it's shocking, as Louisiana in this last legislative session approved a measure that would allow for the Ten Commandments to be posted in the schools, that's drawn lawsuits. And, you know, when you and I graduated from high school, you could still have the Ten Commandments. Actually, it was around that time was when the court ruled that they couldn't be there. I mean, that's a part of it. What do you see in terms of a holistic approach to dealing with the breakdown of society that has brought us these record crime numbers?
Well, so for the people that are engaged in these activities is a lot of hopelessness and trauma. Where do we go for hope? You know, and that's our Lord, you know, and there are churches in these communities, but I found with the young people, there's some trepidation about even going in. There's a trust issue. There's a trust issue with churches for some of them, and there's certainly a trust issue with law enforcement. But the whole thing is same deal like when I got to Estruma High School. They didn't trust me. I believe that the majority of them do now. So it's opening that door and getting inside and getting into the heart and soul of these people.
It's relationship.
It's relationships. Now you could put it. That's where it could stop right there. Relationships. For
so
sure.
So we need churches. When I say churches, pastors are the leaders of churches to engage in the community and build relationships with elected leaders, with community leaders, and so there really needs to be more of the. You know, sit down, have a cup of coffee, work alongside one another to address community issues, as opposed to, you know, finger pointing and the criticism that often comes in these local arenas.
Agreed. That, you know, in law enforcement in particular, there's always task force. Mm-hmm. There's traffic division. There's homicide. There's got to be a what I would call a spiritual task force, and that involves the pastors, the local leaders, the churches, the police officers, EMS, public safety, a task force to work together to reach and build those relationships.
Well, I'll be happy to help you on that front. Also happy to introduce you to some attorneys who you will need, because you will have those on the left that will be suing you for even bringing up such an idea, which 40, 50 years ago was commonplace.
Right.
But I know as a... as a head football coach, you're not going to be intimidated. You're going to do what needs to be done if the Lord opens that door for you. Coach Sid Edwards, I want to thank you for joining us today.
It was my honor. Enjoyed being here. Thank you very much.
Well, folks, I hope you've been encouraged by Coach Sid Edwards' story. And I think it's important that as we see what's happening around us, that we don't just stand on the sidelines and be commentators of the chaos, but rather we step into the arena and we help make a difference. By the way, it starts with voting. Get your voter toolkit. Text toolkit to 67742 so that you are prepared to vote. All right, we're out of time for today. Until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul, found in Ephesians 6, where he says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you have taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com.